Hi, it's Diane. Great to be with you for our Tuesday podcast. On my mind, Danny Shapiro had written 4 memoirs, but no amount of self-exploration could have prepared her for what she learned after taking a DNA test on a whim at age 54. As she writes, it turns out it is possible to live an entire life, even an examined life, and still not know the truth of oneself. That truth, the father who raised her was not her biological dad. It's the topic of her latest memoir, Inheritance, a memoir of genealogy, paternity, and love. Danny Shapiro came into the studio to talk on Tuesday morning. Danny Shapiro, tell us how you grew up. You were an observant Jew, an only child in your family.
Yes, I was raised in suburban New Jersey, just outside New York City. My father was from a long line of Orthodox Jews, observant Jews, a family very conscious of its own posterity and its own history. My mother was also Jewish and of Eastern European Ashkenazi descent, but was not particularly religious. She became religious when she married my father, but her family was not a family that I knew as much about or that I felt as connected to.
And you, even as a young child, began to wonder about yourself because everybody else wondered.
Well, that's it. I mean, when we're children, our sense of identity really comes from the stories that we're told by our families and about ourselves. And the story that I was told and the story that I internalized was that I was this very fair, blue-eyed, pale-skinned, you know, easily prone to blushing little Orthodox Jewish girl. And it was just this anomaly. And it was commented upon pretty much every day of my life. Someone or another would say to me, you don't look Jewish, or you can't possibly be Jewish, or oh, did your mother have an affair with the Swedish milkman, or some version of that, you know, and then later in my life, oh, Shapiro, your married name. It was really a thing. I mean, to the point where when I was 3 years old, I actually was the Kodak Christmas poster child, wishing the entire world a Merry Christmas. And in my family, that was a source of amusement. Isn't it so funny that an observant Jewish girl could be the iconic symbol of American Christmas cheer?
And even Jared Kushner's grandmother said something to you that just made me shiver.
Yeah, so I write in Inheritance, and there's a scene that has stayed with me all my life, and I never really understood it until the last few years, where it was a Saturday afternoon in New Jersey. I was a very small child, and my parents were having lunch. It was Sabbath, or the Shabbos, as we called it, and we were sitting outside, and neighbors came by, and the neighbors were the Kushners. They were a couple older than my parents, and I came out to say hello to the grown-ups. And Mrs. Kushner, who later, much later, became the grandmother of Jared, Mrs. Kushner held my arm, and she patted my head, and she said, "We could have used you in the ghetto, little blondie. You could have gotten us bread from the Nazis."
Ah.
And all my life, that stayed with me, but I attached a certain narrative to it. The narrative that I attached to it was, essentially, I was being told that if I had been alive back then, that I could have made a difference. And so a child internalizes that sense of guilt. But the greater truth, the even deeper truth that I now understand, is that Mrs. Kushner was saying to me, "You're not one of us. You're somehow other," when she said, "Little blondie, we could have used you in the ghetto."
I found myself wondering whether your mother deliberately dropped clues.
I don't think she did. There was only one moment, and it was exactly 2 years after my father's death, on the anniversary of his death. So already I think my mother would have been somewhat triggered by the fact that it was an anniversary. And I introduced her to my friend Rachel, who was from Philadelphia. And I think that the word Philadelphia triggered my mother. I see it almost visually now, like a seam that had been sewn up inside of her, popped a stitch. And she said, "Oh, my daughter was conceived in Philadelphia." I do not think that she ever meant to say that. And then I pushed her, and we did have a conversation. And if we had not had the conversation, because it was very unusual to be 25 years old and suddenly be told where you were conceived. It's the kind of thing that I think we either know or we don't know about ourselves, but we don't usually have a parent like mention that in our mid-20s. And so I pushed my mother a bit. "What do you mean I was conceived in Philadelphia?" And when she described my parents' fertility problems and my father's slow sperm, and then she used the word institute, she said, "We visited an institute," she gave me an incredibly valuable clue that all those years later, I was able to then bring back to mind and begin to unravel the mystery of how I came to be. But I don't think she meant to.
You don't?
No,
you
because
think I think it was accidental.
I don't think my mother held in her consciousness the facts surrounding my conception. I don't think she walked around carrying that with her consciously. I believe that once I was conceived, that there was so much that was done in those days that was meant helpfully by the doctors, but that was designed to essentially, if a parent wanted to believe that it hadn't happened, they could. People were told, "This is a treatment that's going to help you." Women, once they became pregnant, were told, "Oh, the timing is so interesting. You must have already been pregnant when you got here."
Huh.
Couples were told to have sex, do the procedure, and then have sex again, and you'll never really know who the biological father is. There was so much that was done that was meant to obliterate it from consciousness, even though I now know also, because I did so much research, anyone who's still alive and on the planet who knew anything about this, I found them. I tracked them down. I spoke to them. Every book, every academic article, everywhere around the world. And I have such a sense that, on the one hand, couples were told, "This is what we're doing." They signed something. Blood type was matched, and so forth. Characteristics of the father were attempted to be matched. They often also promised that they would try to match religion or ethnicity. That generally went right out the window. There was a dearth of good donors, and so whoever was basically free that day and had an hour between chem lab and, you know, bio class or whatever medical students were doing, you know, that's who ended up there, which is such a very strange thing, Diane, because that's so random. I mean, how I came to be, we all come to be with a certain amount of randomness, right?
Of course.
But the randomness in the case of donor conception is very stark.
What about your father? How do you think he felt about your life and your conception?
This has so much been the journey of the last 2.5 years for me, because I've written book after book after book that in one way or another has been an attempt, consciously or unconsciously on my part, to put my father together, to understand him through writing about him. Why was he so sad? Why did he become more depressed as he got older? Why were my parents so unhappy together? And I've supplied narrative after narrative to those questions. I think everything that I wrote up until this book is all still true. It just wasn't the whole truth. And so when I discovered that my father wasn't my biological father, my first thought was, he must not have known. He couldn't have known. He didn't know. It was a much less painful thought that he didn't know. I preferred the idea that we were both in the dark about this. But I've come to believe the more painful and more likely truth, which is that he knew. This was an institute that when couples went to, they knew why they were going. And I think it would have been a very, very hard decision for him to make to choose that route to having a child. But I think he also would have come to know that it was the only route to having a child, to giving my mother a biological child.
Because she so wanted.
She very, very much wanted. She very, very much wanted a child. And by the time I was born, she was nearly 40, which in those days was really quite old to be having a first child. And my father also, as an observant Jew and a devout, just a person of devotion, be fruitful and multiply is up there with the first commandments. And he would have taken that very seriously. And I think that, you know, there's a moment in my book where an elderly rabbi that I go talk to tells me that he thought my father was a hero.
Yes.
For something that he had done earlier in his life, something really difficult that he had chosen to do that was the moral thing to do. And my trajectory throughout the book was really coming to feel that my father was a hero for the way that he enabled my conception to happen. And he had to live with that.
Exactly. And you describe him as sad. You remember him as sad. Do you think that part of that sadness was your conception?
I do. And it's an irony for me that in all of the years and all of the writing about him in pieces in The New Yorker and in memoirs, that it never occurred to me that I was part of his sadness. I was always trying to mitigate his sorrow. So that was a very painful realization. But I do think that he had a hard life in a lot of ways, and he had already experienced quite a bit of loss and tragedy. I know he adored me, but I think that that was a sorrow, especially as I got older, because there were ways in which we were so bonded and connected.
Yes.
But there were also ways in which I was different. I was just different. It's too easy to attribute that simply to genetics, that I had different genetics and I had a different biological father. But yet at the same time, there was a sense of my being a little bit different. I was never going to remain, for example, an Orthodox Jew. That just wasn't going to happen. I mean, from the time that I was a little kid, I knew that that wasn't my path in life.
And now a quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Danny Shapiro.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Danny Shapiro. Her latest book is titled Inheritance, a memoir of genealogy, paternity, and love. The issue of how you discovered your otherness is a story unto itself.
That 36 hours from the moment that I realized through the randomness of doing a DNA test that my dad had not been my biological father, it took 36 hours from the moment that I realized that and was in a state of profound shock, because I really had never suspected that, until the moment that I was looking at the face of the man who is my biological father on a YouTube video. That was kind of a staggering, the feeling was almost one of being a kind of fate. It was so unlikely that I would find him. There are so many people out there who never are able to trace back their paternity, and especially in this moment in time where the combination of these easy, inexpensive, accessible, popular DNA tests that have become the number one Christmas and Hanukkah gift for all families. They're stocking stuffers in you know, Merry Christmas, family, we're going to do our DNA together. And secrets are tumbling out at such a rapid rate, the combination of the internet and DNA testing. And so it wasn't difficult. My husband and I had a couple of hunches. first of all, my mother had given me enough of a clue that I understood that I was donor conceived. I understood that my mother hadn't had an affair, that there wasn't another story. I understood that that was the likeliest story. And then my husband and I thought, well, who would a sperm donor have been at an institute in Philadelphia in 1961? And we both thought a medical student.
Medical student. Of course.
Right.
Of course.
I don't know how we did, but we just did. And then, so a medical student at Penn. That seemed like the likeliest scenario. And then we had one clue beyond the word institute in Philadelphia. And it was a big clue. And without that clue, I wouldn't have been able to find my biological father. And that was that a first cousin had appeared on my Ancestry.com page who was a stranger to me. I knew all my first cousins. And here was this man. It was a blue icon. And he was identified only by initials. But there was the name of someone who was administering his page on Ancestry.com. And with using that name and some journalistic skills, and, you know, my husband's a former investigative journalist.
Yes.
But, you know, I really have to say, most people would have been able to get there. We got there fast, but the clues were there. And so using nothing more than Facebook and Google, we found this cousin. And I will never forget for the rest of my life looking at this Facebook page of this man in Ohio and thinking, if you are my first cousin, then an uncle of yours would have to be my biological father. And then looking up, his mother had passed away, and there was an obituary. And there in the obituary was, survived by a brother, and there was a name, and the brother was a doctor. And Googled the doctor, and there he was with a bio, and he had gone to University of Pennsylvania medical school. And then because he's a retired physician and he has a specialty in medical ethics, he was giving a lecture on YouTube at a college in Oregon.
Tell me about your reaction as you saw his face the very first time.
It was surreal to recognize myself in a stranger. I recognized myself. And it wasn't just a physical thing. Certainly, I saw that I looked like him, because I really do look a tremendous amount like him. But it actually was something deeper than that. He was gesturing. He was behind a lectern, and he was speaking, which is something I do often. And he was gesturing with his hands. And he was making a certain gesture with his hands, which is something that I do, that's been pointed out to me or that I've seen in videos of myself. And then he started doing a Q&A with the audience. And I remember the first thing that I said, which was to my husband who was sitting next to me, was, my God, he even runs a Q&A like me. There was something in the way that he was calling on the person in the back row and the way that he was tilting his head and smiling slightly. And there was a manner that was familiar. And in seeing its familiarity, I also had to encounter the fact that that was not something that I had with my dad. I had great love and devotion with my father, but I didn't have familiarity with him. And it was just there in front of me.
So then came your decision as to whether to write him.
It didn't even feel like a decision, Diane. I was trying to put myself together, trying to find out at the age of 54 that you're not who you thought you were, that you're not made of who you thought you were made of, is a kind of destabilizing thing. You know, we use that expression, the rug is pulled out from under me. It literally, that is what it felt like. It felt groundless beneath me. And I wanted to do whatever I could to rebuild that ground to understand who and where I came from. And so, yeah, I mean, against what would be conventional advice, I wrote to him. I figured, you know what, I'm a writer. I do know how to write a good letter. I'm good at emails. And I wrote him a very careful note.
Short.
It was short. I introduced myself. I told him that this note might come as a shock, that I had always believed that my parents were my biological parents, but that I now had reason to believe that he might be my biological father. I described myself. I said, I'm a novelist and memoirist and teacher and wife and mom, and I live in Connecticut. I included a link to my website, which I did very, very purposefully because I wanted him to see that I was someone with a life and a successful career and a family of my own, and also that I look very much like him, which he would have seen instantly. What it didn't occur to me was that the first thing he would also have seen when he clicked over to my website was Oprah with her arm around me, and the fact that I'm a writer who has spent my life writing about family and identity and roots. So that probably didn't please him so much because he's a very private person.
I must say, I give so much credit to your husband for his acceptance and encouragement through this whole process.
I don't think I could have gotten through this without
him. He was wonderful.
He was utterly wonderful. He became this kind of dogged reporter, researcher. He is the reason why I did the Ancestry.com testing to begin with, just on a lark. And very early on, I remember Michael, my husband, saying to me, do you wish that you hadn't done it? You know, I think he felt bad. He felt like, you know, if he hadn't done that, I would have just been in the dark my whole life. There is no part of me that wishes I didn't know.
So the note you received back.
The initial note back was very careful. It was essentially saying, I'm a retired doctor. I live in a retirement community with my wife and of 50 years and are surrounded by our children and grandchildren, which was, I think I parsed it as a way of saying, please don't disrupt, don't upend my life. But he did absolutely the kindest and most ethical thing. He did write back to me. I offered to give him more information to explain to him how I had arrived at this. And he said, if you'd like to send more information, we'll be glad to review it. He let me know that I was right. You know, there's a refrain in my book several times, which is how old is too old for a surprise. You know, I was very aware of putting myself in his shoes and imagining being this retired 78-year-old doctor with a quiet and very happy life and then having this sort of crash into it. So he wrote back to me. I wrote to him. I explained the entire story of how I had arrived at him. He knew that it was the truth that we were both looking at. And he wrote back to me and he offered medical history. He did the right thing. It wasn't until I wrote to him and I said that it would mean a lot to me to be able to meet him and that I would fly across the country for a cup of coffee. I was looking for, again, that kind of groundedness of, it didn't seem real to me. Even though I knew it was true, it didn't seem real. And I felt like perhaps by sitting across the table from him, it might actually sink in a way that I would begin to be able to metabolize.
And his first response
His initial response to that was he kind of closed the door. He said, I can't do this. I'm just not interested, and I wish you luck, and this is going to be my final communication with you. And after that, only 2 weeks went by. Very difficult 2 weeks, but and this is going to sound like a strange thing to say, I had a feeling more was going to happen.
And Michael,
both had this feeling that this, it didn't sound like him, which again is a strange thing to say about someone that you don't know, but it didn't sound like his previous communication. It sounded almost like he was reflexively just closing the door because he got scared. And 2 weeks later, I opened my email one day. I was in the car with my son and my husband, and the subject line of the email was second thoughts. And he wrote to say that he and his wife were going to be traveling east and that he had been giving a lot of thought to the fact that it might be important to both of us to experience meeting each other, and he hoped that I would still be willing.
Gosh.
Yeah.
What a meeting that was.
Yeah, there's no playbook for meeting your biological father for the first time at the age of 54. There just isn't. When we were driving there, it was Michael and myself and my biological father, who I call Ben Walden in the book, and his wife.
We should say you changed all the names.
I told him very early on, once we were communicating, that I would be writing about this. I mean, my God, it's the book that everything else has led to.
Of
there was
course.
No way I wasn't going to write about it, but I very much wanted to protect his privacy and believe I have.
How did his wife react at that luncheon?
She was lovely at the lunch. She was warm. This was not easy for her. She had never known that her husband had been a sperm donor when he was in medical school. He didn't hide it from her. He just never thought about it. Because I think for all of these guys, or for many of them, it just was no big deal. And it was also something that was always going to be a secret. No one was ever going to know. And one thing I've learned about secrets in the last few years is that if you are told from the start that it just simply cannot be revealed, it's out of the question, it's a secret that will go to the grave with you, it can become a secret that you keep from yourself as well.
You are giving lots of hope to others.
So much of what I feel a sense of purpose about, aside from, you know, that I hope that I've written a book that's about identity and family and what makes a father and themes that would be interesting to everybody. But in terms of the world of adoptees and people who have been donor conceived who are finding this out now in their 30s or 40s or 50s or 60s, or I recently heard about a 78-year-old woman who just found out that her father hadn't been her biological
wow.
father. This is just happening.
Wow.
And it's really about it having been kept a secret. It's not about the fact of it itself. It's about the secrecy of it. And the sense that once those secrets are exposed, once light has been shined on the darkness where they festered. I mean, I was formed all my life by what I didn't know.
So now, Danny, that you know, how does this change or affect your sense of you?
There's a sense of integration that I never completely had. Something was always slightly askew. There was something I didn't understand from the time Mrs. Kushner patted my head, that feeling of otherness or of being different or not belonging. And even though I grew up and built a life for myself that I love, there was always something that didn't quite make sense. And there's tremendous liberation in that something that didn't make sense being gone.
And what about the practice of Judaism?
If anything, I feel less conflicted because I always felt like, on the one hand, I'm this Orthodox Jewish girl, and on the other hand, I don't feel like I belong in any of these places, and there must be something wrong with me that I feel that I don't belong. And now the face looking back at me in the mirror makes sense for the first time. And I feel, if anything, more connected to my Jewish heritage and to the dad who raised me. I mean, one thing I feel like it's really that I want to say is that meeting my biological father, I didn't feel like I was meeting my father. I felt that I was meeting the land that I came from, the country that I'm from, the cloth that I'm cut from. But he didn't feel like my father because he didn't raise me. He didn't love me into being. He didn't form me psychologically. My dad did. And especially knowing now what I know about my father and what he did and the path that he took to become willing to have me, to make me, I feel in the end that I come from three people, you know, my mother and my father and my biological father. They all contributed to my being able to exist.
Danny Shapiro, congratulations on this beautiful book. And good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and the even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers are Douglas Bell and Natalie Yurev-Lipker. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you on Friday. I'm Diane Rehm.